when we look at an investment, we will look at it from an investor standpoint. So we have to do our due diligence on them. It's not like, hey, can I hire you? Sure, pay me this much and I'm hired. It's like we have to feel good about who we're working for.
Welcome to Surgeon Syndicate. If you're paying attention, you know that you only make money when you work. It might be great money, but it's dependent on you. The information on this podcast will help you solve that. We interview experts and provide analysis into financial freedom through commercial real estate. Why? To help physicians like you thrive. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Surgeon Syndicate. This is your host, Dr. Michael McManus. We are here today with Amit Gagalani. Amit is a physical therapist and physical therapy entrepreneur who personally invested as a limited partner across many syndications till he decided to form a company to help syndicators outsource their investors department. He helps them raise capital by nurturing retail investors. Amit, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Pleasure to be on it.
So as a physical therapist, obviously, if you're in real estate now, that wasn't your first choice. Tell us a little bit about your story and how you got to where you're at now.
Yeah, so it's funny because where you start is never where you end. And your intention is to be out there the best clinician that you can be. And that's all I wanted to do. And before I knew it, then I was became a business owner. And once again, as a business owner, I just wanted to be the best clinician I could be. Fast forward, like I realized that I needed to get an education as a CEO if I really wanted to understand the business application of it, right? So I did that. And as I did that, I started scaling my business. And I loved treating patients, but it became evident that as I was scaling and we were adding on clinicians, that my role was going to be more important as a CEO. And I started segueing from constantly treating to treating less and less and wearing the CEO hat, because we added on offices and offices. To a certain point, we had about 4 offices, 12 clinicians. And then I guess I had the aha moment that if I really want to 10X this whole venture, that I need to kind of figure out where I'm going to go next. Either I can keep battling it out against insurance companies and against what I saw was ACOs and accountable care organizations, for those who are not familiar with the term, as well as hospital structures that were buying out primary care practices and kind of telling them where they had to refer. And I said, this is getting harder and harder. I was yet still too small to be able to negotiate with insurance companies. So I said, okay, well, what else is out there? Either I can partner with a known entity, which is a larger physical therapy company, or I could partner with a private equity company that's looking to get into healthcare. And I kind of evaluated both. I ended up partnering with a private equity, and then we sat down and we started growing the company, and we grew it to about 100 different offices. You know, of course, there's a lot of nuances in there.
So are you still running the physical therapy company, or did you then go ahead and exit that?
So we built it to about 100 different offices. And after that, another private equity came along and bought the whole thing out. They bought my shares. So I exited out at that time.
Okay. How often do you see that in the physical therapy space? Because you see now a lot of multiple offices, same name, rather than mom and pop physical therapy.
Yeah, the playing field for physical therapy is such that private equity models, as well as larger physical therapy models, are buying out the mom and pop. Okay, so you see that quite often happening. What you don't really see happening is a physical therapist that is not really treating patients anymore. It has a more of an administrative role in their own company, and they're doing like the executive role. Usually what happens is mom and pop owners stay mom and pop owners. So they're owner operators, right? They're operating the business and they're in the business treating patients, and they're still making money that way. They're not usually breaking off to saying, hey, I'm going to be a full-time executive in my company. So you don't see that very often at all.
Did you get any pushback from your peers as you moved out of being a treating clinician as if you were doing the wrong thing, or was that more accepted in the physical therapy world?
So it's interesting. In the physical therapy world, you don't have some things that you do in the medicine world. Like if you have a medical practice and someone is going to join, the first thing they want to know nowadays is like, well, do I have a partner track? Can I be a partner? Physical therapists don't ever ask that question. They want to be an employee. So they're never trying to be a partner. I shouldn't say never. I would say on the majority, this usually happens. They like the comfort of being a W-2 and knowing that. They don't like the risk-taking of being a physical therapist that's in business for themselves. So there you go. It wasn't really looked down upon from my physician's friend's point of view. They were like, wow, you're able to scale. You're able to do that, because a lot of them would love to be able to do these things. But in their environment, it just wasn't something that they could do. They just felt like they were kind of trapped in certain circumstances. They were trapped in that hamster wheel.
That's interesting, because I think that's changed, where it used to be doctors expected to be in private practice. I know I kind of came out of med school as that shift was happening from majority private practice to majority employed. And I think most docs now come out and they accept, or they just anticipate, like you said, being an employee and don't think about being a partner. And there's a small number who want to be in private practice. And maybe that number is bigger if you found guys who are like, I wish I could do the same, but they're stuck in a model where it's hard to be on your own now.
Yeah. And the larger entities that are out there, they just make it easier for the physician or the physical therapist just to be a W-2, right? There are very large entities that have commanding power when it comes to negotiating of rates and things like that, benefits, and they kind of make it easier on the physician too. Like, all you need to do is practice. You don't need to worry about the actual practice. You just do what you went to school for. We'll take care of everything else. So for certain people, that's beautiful. For certain entrepreneurial people, that's like a death sentence.
You decide you're stuck, and it's interesting. For a while, I had almost a jealousy towards the people who were kind of set and churning along in their career and completely happy with it. And I was like, yeah, wow, that would be so much easier if that was my path. But I got bored and needed to do something different.
It's a great path in one aspect. It's a horrible path in another aspect. It's a great path if you're like, you know what, I'm very happy waking up, going to work, and then coming home and I don't have any responsibilities, but I know how much income I'm going to make. Yes, there's a bonus plan, but I don't decide that bonus plan, and I'm getting a piece of the full action. Whereas if you're the business owner, you're like, well, if I cut down expenses, the more patients that I see, the more profit that I can make, I can scale this and I can add on other clinicians and I can give them the smaller piece and take some and still make them happy, but at the same time, get a piece of the whole thing. So it really depends on your mindset, right? For some people, they don't want the headache. For some people, yep, they relish in that headache because they think that that's a game. Like, it's honestly your viewpoint. If you view business as a game and a game that you want to win, then every morning you're waking up attacking that game. If you wake up and you're like, oh, this is such a pain in the butt, then that's your mindset on it.
It's interesting. The difference I saw with doctors as they went through being purchased and becoming part of a bigger system. I still remember there was a small orthopedics practice, and the guys used to fight over, they'd be going to the receptionist and being like, why does he have 31 patients and I only have 29? You're not splitting it evenly. Because once your expenses are met, that extra patient is all profit. And so there was always this desire to add on more. And then they sold their practice to the hospital. I was talking to their PA and he was like, oh no, it took one day. And the next day they're at the reception out there going, how come I have 30 and he has 29? But the motivations totally changed once they were employed. And I know that doesn't go across the board, but it's interesting how it changes motivations. I guess it depends on how things are structured and the group and all that. Did you find a difference in the motivations between, like, people you know who were business owners yourself and the clinicians who were coming in and were strictly just wanted a job, on what drove them and what it was they were looking for in a job?
Majority of my friends that were physicians, surgeons, everything, they were all independently practicing on their own. So they weren't employed by the hospital. So there's a certain mindset with everybody with them, that they're very collaborative because they all want the business to grow together. And they know it's not like me all myself. Like, I need to refer. I need to figure out what are my referral patterns. I want to send it to people that I know, like, and trust, and that will refer back to me. That also doesn't make me look bad, right? So, and when you're in private practice, you're constantly thinking, like, I want to make sure, A, the physician who referred these patients looks good, in the sense that your doctor did a great job on this surgery. Obviously, they have to do a good job on the surgery, but you want to keep it tight because you want to keep those strong referral patterns going. And also, if there's any issue, you're able to pick up your cell phone right away and text your friend and say, hey, I'm noticing this, this, and this going on with your ACL reconstruction. They don't have full knee extension yet, and this many weeks post-op, we need to get in there and take a look at what's going on. Direct line of communication, and they're texting you back right away. you get to bypass a lot of things. And the patients appreciate it because the communication is better and ultimately their results are better. Whereas I did have some physicians that were in the hospital network, they really just didn't care. It was like, okay, let me see the patient. I shouldn't say they didn't really care. It just wasn't the same level of like intensity. Whereas somebody who's in private practice just had a different level of intensity.
Okay.
That's what I always say.
That's okay. Well, there's a difference between, I think, when you're on a salary and that the patients are owned by a healthcare system and the healthcare system drives them in versus every patient is your living and their happiness. Right. What do they say? Every unhappy person tells, I forget what it is, a bunch of people, and that the happy people don't. So you don't want unhappy patients, and that drives outcomes.
Yes.
It just changes the motivations a little bit. All right. So how then did your real estate journey start as you were expanding locations as part of being an owner operator from the real estate standpoint, or did it come in from somewhere else?
While I was expanding my company, I realized I loved the idea of real estate, but I didn't know how to get started in it. And the other thing that kind of scared me at the time was I didn't want somebody calling me up and saying, my toilet is broken. Can you help fix it? Can you do something about this? But basically a tenant complaint. I was like, I don't know how I would squeeze it in. I don't know what I know now, but at the time that was my concern and that was my fear. So these things called syndications started happening and I said, this is really interesting. So I started listening to these podcasts about syndications, gathering my knowledge and really just educating myself on it. And that started my journey to start investing in syndications and being an LP, but being able to back, let's say, the strong horse. And then the people who knew how to do the operations, they did the operations, but I also got income from that, passive income from it. So that started my whole journey on it. And I was doing that for about 8-9 years. And as I was doing it, my friends who were physicians started noticing and said, hey, can we join in? We'd like to join in with what you're doing too. So then they joined in. So it just gave me added money to be able to negotiate sometimes with syndicators in that respect.
So you almost started with a fund before there were funds.
I started with my personal funds and started investing and I started liking it. And then I shared it with other people and they said, sure, we'll join you. So then when people join and say, okay, I'm going to put in money, I'm going to put in money. And then you go to the syndicator and say, well, I have $2 million to invest. You know, a rate that you're offering everybody else is not good enough for us. Can you do better? So then they would give us a higher rate of return because they're getting $2 million. And with that higher rate of return, we would internally share that higher rate of return. So everybody who's putting that money in now is getting a higher rate of return, even though they're putting in a small amount. So it was like something for nothing almost.
That's awesome. So people will ask me, and this is one that I just like to keep covering because people will ask, why when you bring more money, would the syndicator give you better rates?
Yeah, well, there's multiple reasons. Sometimes the syndicator has a timeline that they have to close this deal within a certain amount of time. So when they go into contract, depending on how the structure is, if it's ground up construction, it's a little bit different. But if they're buying a property, when you're buying something from someone else, you have a certain time period. Sometimes it's 90 days, sometimes it's 120 days to get the deal done. So the clock starts ticking and you need to make sure you get the money in. So somebody's coming up to you and saying, hey, I'm going to give you a large swath of money, but we need better terms. You're like, okay, because I get that large amount and it's that much closer for me to close now, as opposed to small increments of money. And you're wondering, oh my God, am I going to make it or not? Because you have to make it. And what happens if you don't make it, the money that you put into the deal, what they call hard money or the money that goes hard, you lose it if you can't get the full amount. So you don't want to lose your money that you put in. Okay. So in certain respects, it's because of that. In the other respects, because it takes them, a syndicator, time and it takes them money to market to actually get funds from retail investors to come in because you have to have, A, you have to know that many retail investors, okay? And it takes marketing to do that. So if you can save on marketing dollars and you can save on time, you'd rather give somebody a higher percentage because you just shortcutted the whole process.
Wow, that's awesome. We talked about it previously on the show, but more from the back end and the cost of communicating with more investors on the backside. But
there's another part of it that's huge too. The other part is the more investors that you get onto your deals, and obviously if you're a good operator and you're giving the returns that you promise, then those investors are happy. So the next time you have a deal, you already have a source of funding. You just go back to them and you say, would you like to roll it forward? Would you like to do another deal with me? And a certain percentage will say, absolutely. You've been very good. You've been very transparent. You've been very communicative. We'd love to do it. So on the next raise, it makes it that much easier. So the more investors you keep having, the more deals you do, the faster you actually can get your raises done.
We'll get back to our show in a minute, but first I want to offer you an opportunity to accelerate your learning. My life changed and my ability to start becoming work optional changed when I gained the people and the knowledge to start investing in commercial real estate. One of the key people there was Ash Patel and joining his Invest Beyond Multifamily Mastermind. With that, I had the people and the knowledge. Well, that mastermind is no longer open, but for a fraction of the price, Ash has now made a course, and this is probably the most valuable set of information, the quickest way to move along your learning curve. So if you are interested in actively investing in commercial real estate and retail and industrial and office, I would recommend this course to you. We're going to include a pre-sale link both in the show notes. It'll also be on the surgeonsyndicate.com website. And in your checkout, we'll save you another 1%. I know it's not a lot, but every little bit helps if you use the discount code MIKE1487. So take that step now and move your future forward. If you're not interested in investing actively, give us a call here at Fortress Capital. And let's talk about what your goals are as a passive investor. But it's time to stop listening, start acting, and let's move your future forward.
So now your role where you came in with your new company, because you talk about a lot of that a lot of investors, they have different perspectives on how much communication they want from their syndicator. How much have you seen of that as far as like big differences, small differences, as far as what the people investing want to hear back?
Yeah. So I will tell you, we as investors are a very fickle bunch. Some of us like to be communicated by video webinars. Some of us like to be communicated by a text message. Some of us like to just get an email once a month. Some of us don't want to look at any of it at all. So to say that there's a one size fits all, it's very difficult. At the very minimum, they should be sending out something once every 2 months or once every month, just updating, hey, this is where the project is at. Sometimes those emails go into spam and nobody ever sees them. And that happens all the time. They'll say, hey, I never got an email. You're not sending them out. And the syndicator's like, sure, I am. It's probably in your junk folder. So that's there. And some of them like it when there's a video, a quick 15-minute video, and they kind of know what's going on. And that's great. Most people, and myself included, don't like the idea. I put money somewhere and I have no idea what's going on with it.
And that's different because there's the difference between buying stock where you can go to the company's website or you can go to Yahoo Finance or whatever and read articles about what's going on with the company. You don't find those articles about a syndicator. So yeah. For the work that you do now with your company where you're kind of outsourcing that investor relations for bigger syndicators, tell me more about that.
So after I had sold out my physical therapy company, meaning when the other private equity came and I was completely out, okay, then some syndicators had approached me and say, hey, do you want to work with us? Because you've been raising capital all the time, unofficially, for your own investments, but do you want to help us out? Because we have some things that we want to close up and you've been helpful in the past. I actually said no a bunch of times because I wanted to take a break and I think I shared with you the story. Like, I thought I wanted to do all these things in my new free time, and I did them in 2 hours a day, and then I was just bored all day long. So after 2 weeks, 2 weeks is like a vacation period, right? After that, then you start getting bored because you wake up in the morning and you're like, okay, what am I going to do today? Whereas before, when you're building your company, you're constantly focused on building your company. So what started happening was, okay, I was like, okay, well, I'm starting getting bored and I'm too young not to do something. So I said, sure, let me go help them out. That became its own business because then I started helping them to raise capital, do these communication cycles and just do these things. And I formed a company, which my company would get hired to help them. I don't want to say just raise capital, but it was also more or less communicate, just like I call it, an outsourced investor relations department. That led from one job to another person saying, hey, we need help, to another person saying, we need help. And what we kind of saw that was missing in the market per se was an outsourced investor relations department, as opposed to, hey, let me just raise money for you. The difference, I will say, is when we look at an investment, we will look at it from an investor standpoint. So we have to do our due diligence on them. It's not like, hey, can I hire you? Sure, pay me this much and I'm hired. It's like we have to feel good about who we're working for. And one of the main reasons is we have our own book of business. As I said, my friends and my family who were involved in those deals. So in order for me to feel comfortable to share the investment with those people, I would have to feel comfortable to want to invest myself. So I have a whole due diligence process that I have to follow. And then if everything checks out, then we will work with that syndicator. If it doesn't work out, then we will say, no, we can't really work with you.
Is there a difference between what you're doing and running a fund?
Yeah. Because whenever with this, what I'm doing is I'm representing the syndicator. Okay. I've done my due diligence so I can represent them, meaning that I feel good about this investment and I will tell all my friends about it and I will share it with them. And I will say, if this is something that you want to invest, here's the upside. Go ahead and invest. And also for that syndicator, outside of my friends, we are trying to help them figure out how to get those capital sources, whether it's us doing webinars for them, whether it's Facebook ads, whether it's in-person seminars, whether it's those things, we're doing those activities on behalf of their company, which is very different than an actual raising for a fund, because if you're raising for a fund itself, then I guess I'm the syndicator, right? Then I'm the operator of that thing. I know that who I'm backing is somebody that has operational experience in that area, where I don't know how to do a 50-unit multifamily. That's not my experience.
Okay. As far as versus just working in the GP, being a capital raiser and outsourcing the investor relations. So with your company, are you guys in the GP in that traditional capital raising role, or you're hired as a service to do the investor relations, but you're not taking just any client?
That's exactly right. Yeah, we have nothing to do with the GP on the GP side of it. We're not incentivized in that manner. We are basically not even incentivized. There's no incentive other than, what does your syndication need? Well, this is what it would need. So this is how much it would cost to hire us. Basically, like you are hiring an internal person, but you're just doing it as an outsourced person. And why do it as an outsourced person? Because you're hiring not one person, you're hiring a company to do it for you, and a company that has experience with doing similar projects like this and has similar capabilities of talking to business owners as well as W-2 employees and understands their mentality. So it's easier for us to have that kind of communication with them. And we've done so many different deals, even me personally. I've personally invested in like multifamily, self-storage, natural gas, oil, ATMs, just different things. So I just understand the structure.
So that helps them, because if you say, yeah, I'm good at finding deals, I'm good at running deals and making the parts work. Some people are really good at that. But then when it comes to telling their investors about it or communicating that, they're not so good.
And we find that quite a lot. The people that want us to help them out, they know they're good operators. They know what they're good at. But they also know that they don't like, I shouldn't say they don't like, they also know that the follow-up with investors and going over the questions takes a lot of time, and that time gets taken away from what they need to do in the operation side. So they know they can't dedicate that to it. And if they can, they can answer a few questions, but then they have to do that. And there's no follow-up. And without follow-up, then sales don't actually happen. So they know that they're not the best person to do this role.
That makes sense, because you think about all the people who their mentality is so into the deal.
Yes.
They're very good at that. And they're very good about talking about a deal with somebody who understands the inside of a deal and the lingo. But to talk to somebody on the outside, they just leave them shaking their head like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So
right. And what happened, and I'll give you my example, let's go back a bit. When I was in physical therapy and I was doing my due diligence on these deals and I was ready to invest, I would have to explain it to all my physician friends. And these are intelligent individuals, but they don't understand these deals, right? Because it's very different. It's very foreign. So I would have to explain, this is AAR or this is IRR. This is how the deal is going to work. This is the pref rate and this is how the pref rate works. And this is what we're going to get on the back end. So I'm having to explain it again and again and again and again. So that just led to me being able to talk to investors and telling them in a short amount of time, this is why it benefits you to do this investment, as opposed to all the different dynamics of everything that goes on and just losing somebody mentally.
You know, it's interesting how you, when we're new to something, because I remember when I was new to syndications, and I read Joe Fairless's book, and there's the whole, like, the list of the lingo. And you're like, I'm a smart person. I've studied for a million tests. I went to medical school. A lot of it's very similar. It's like taking statistics where they're not that different. And until you really get into it, it can be really confusing. And I remember going through that stage, and I got the book on Audible, and I just listened to it over and over and over again until I knew what they were going to say. And I'm like, now I see how this all works. And then it doesn't look so complex. But as a doctor, where you're used to understanding things, and I don't know where this goes sideways, and maybe it's because there's no one thing that is really all that complex when you look at it, but it becomes a ton of lingo and it's all moving. Like, how does the capital stack and when it shifts and when does it go from a 50-50 to an 80-20 and why does that happen? And as a doc, I think part of it is you feel like you should understand it sooner than you do. And then you feel kind of dumb. And you're like, I don't like this feeling of dumb.
I did all these smart things. Why do I want to be dumb in this area?
I'm going to go put my money someplace that doesn't make me feel dumb. Because that was a hard part for a long time getting over it. Because once you think you understand it and then you see a little different structure and it doesn't make sense again. And you're like, wait a minute, I thought I understood this stuff. How did it all go sideways?
I would have to write it down, Mike. I would literally listen to podcasts and write things down and then have to look it up more than one time until it became like, oh, okay, I know this. And then I'd listen to it again. Like, now I understand what they're saying. Like, now I understand what this is.
Yeah. And then you shift an asset class and the way operators in different asset classes talk about things, like the setup of a syndication on a land development versus a multifamily can be so different. And then when you get exposed to it again to a new asset class, you're like, wait a minute, I thought I understood this. And now I'm back in the, what are they talking about again? So,
And there's a lot of things that are misunderstood by people. Internal rate of return. And that's something that people have just gotten used to hearing. And now people don't even use internal rate of return as their metric all the time, because they're like, internal rate of return was great when the market was really frothy and turnover was happening right away. And we know that the internal rate of return is contingent upon how fast you're going to be getting your money back. So the shorter the time cycle for the investment and you're getting your money back, the better the IRR. But when the economy changes and we don't know what interest rates are going to be, and now your time cycles go stretched, doesn't mean it's a bad deal. It just means that, hey, we don't know if it's going to happen in 5 years. So we're going to predict 7 or 8 years just because we don't know what's going on. Now, all of a sudden, the IRR starts to go down. But it doesn't mean it's a bad deal. It just means you're trying to mitigate risk. But people will say, no, I only do the deal if it's above 17% IRR. But like, look, we're mitigating the risk. And that's why it's less than 17, not because it's a bad deal.
All right. Yeah. And so time changes where all the things that worked in kind of a frothy, low interest rate environment now change. And so those metrics, again, are kind of different.
Correct. Like I said, it doesn't mean it's a bad deal. But if you're setting your parameters saying, I don't do deals unless it's this IRR and this frame or these things, everything changes when like the interest rate goes up, because what you were accepting and thought it was okay before when interest rates were low and that time value was very short, because you could do deals fast. You could buy it in June and in July it's worth more and you didn't do anything to it. It's just the appreciation went up that much.
How much are you finding that with interest rates higher and people able to get 5% in the bank now instead of 0.1%, the difference in how investors are looking at real estate investments?
So a lot of syndicators have been doing something called debt deals, where they're setting up debt funds, right? And the idea of the debt fund is, hey, we're going to give you a high interest rate if you put your money with us. You give us $50,000, we're going to give you 7-8% interest, simple interest. It's you're getting payments on a monthly basis, monthly, quarterly, or we'll even compound them for you, but it's a very simple formula. We're going to be utilizing that money inside of our properties, inside of what we do. And because we're doing that, it's a cheaper form of debt for us. And because we're utilizing your money, we're going to pay you 7-8%. People are like, I don't know if I really want 7-8%. If I can put my money at a bank and get 5.25% that FDIC secured, for that 2 or 3 extra percent, do I want to take that risk? So what people would have loved at some point, now they're like, I don't know if I want to do that. They can lock up their CD for a little bit more. They can put it into regular savings and still get that much. So the mentality is like a little bit different that we notice.
Are you finding them more reluctant to go into deals as a limited partner at the same time because they can get a better interest rate, or that spread's still big enough that people are either put it in the bank or real estate investor?
So what we find is in the investor like mindset, you're talking about many different investors and everybody's at a different season in their life. The younger guys who are like, hey, I make enough money and I want to invest it somewhere, they want more equity positions because they don't need the cash flow now. They want to basically plant a seed for a brighter future later and have a higher multiple on exit. They don't care if it's 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years from now. They don't need the cash flow right now, so they'd rather do that. Somebody who's in their 60s or 70s, they're like, hey, we're not worried about 5, 10 years from now. We want something that's secure. So we like debt deals because we know that our money is there. We know we're going to get a high interest rate for it. We also know that we can pull the money back out at given intervals. So they like those type of deals. Or they like deals where they're getting a preferred interest rate and they're getting most of their cash flow up front. And then part of it comes later. So they like those types of deals. So it really depends on who you're talking to, and you have to know your customer when you're talking to them. You actually have to ask them, what type of things do you like? Are you into? And tell us so that way we can bring you the type of deals that suit you instead of me trying to talk to you about something you have no interest in.
For everybody listening, thank you for joining us. This is my first podcast where we had to move due to repair work being done on an investment property. So there we go. Sometimes you get repairs that interrupt other things and it's not the way you'd hoped it would be. Actually, we found out about the flashing got torn off in a big windstorm. And we found out because we got an off-market offer and the guy called and he's like, oh, and you should know there's a big piece of flashing hanging off that blew loose. And it wasn't like a tactic like, oh, the place is falling apart. He was just like, oh, none of the tenants had said anything, but it was somebody who's interested in buying the property that actually let us know. So with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of Surging Syndicate. I hope that this show has given you some great insight into some of the investor relation pieces that go into syndications. Please join us for the second half of this conversation with Amit, and we're going to dive a little deeper into some of the fears and the struggles that investors go through getting to their first investment and things that even experienced investors are having trouble with right now because of things going on in the world. Amit's going to help us dive a little deeper into maybe some things that investors can do to get through some of that fear. So join us next time on Surging Syndicate. We'll get back to our show in a minute, but first I want to offer you an opportunity to accelerate your learning. My life changed and my ability to start becoming work optional changed when I gained the people and the knowledge to start investing in commercial real estate. One of the key people there was Ash Patel and joining his Invest Beyond Multifamily Mastermind. With that, I had the people and the knowledge. Well, that mastermind is no longer open, but for a fraction of the price, Ash has now made a course. And this is probably the most valuable set of information and quickest way to move along your learning curve. So if you are interested in actively investing in commercial real estate and retail and industrial and office, I would recommend this course to you. We're going to include a pre-sale link both in the show notes. It'll also be on the surgeonsyndicate.com website. And in your checkout, we'll save you another 1%. I know it's not a lot, but every little bit helps if you use the discount code MIKE1487. So take that step now and move your future forward. If you're not interested in investing actively, give us a call here at Fortress Capital. And let's talk about what your goals are as a passive investor. But it's time to stop listening, start acting, and let's move your future forward. This has been an episode of Surging Syndicate. If you found value in this episode, know other surgeons are hungry to become job optional. You can help them by sharing this content today. I also want to serve you better, so I want to offer you two things. Number one, I'll be able to give you the content in an even better way if you can take a moment and leave an honest review of the show explaining what you like
and what you don't. Number two, if you are a surgeon and serious about this, you don't want to do this on your own because you don't want to make mistakes with your money. I'd be happy to help. Schedule a call and we can make a plan. Looking forward to having you with me on the next episode.